Good evening, and welcome to the Natural History Museum of Utah's 2016 lecture series, now wrapping up our 10th year. I'm Sarah George, the Executive Director of the Museum, and it's great to see you all here tonight. I want to also welcome our radio audience listening to the rebroadcast on KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM. This year, we are unraveling the unknown and meeting 21st century explorers who are expanding our understanding of the world. We kicked off the series with astronauts Mark and Scott Kelly, and they had a great conversation talking about exploration into the outer reaches of the solar system. We also have heard from Dr. Phyllis Coley, who described her remarkable work in the rainforest, including thinking about how we can contribute to conservation and sustainability of local communities. And then we heard from Zoltan Takash, who travels the globe in search of the world's deadliest toxins. Tonight we wrap up our series with Dr. David Gallo, and I will introduce him in just a moment. First, I want to thank our incredible sponsors and partners who make it possible for the museum to produce a series like this each year. We're especially grateful to our founding underwriter, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, and our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund, for their tremendous and ongoing support of this series. We also want to thank our gold sponsor, Rio Tinto Kennecott, silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DeFiore Family Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. And I want to acknowledge our media partner, KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM. We also have great support from community partners, the City Library, Kingsbury Hall, Liberty Heights Fresh, and the Viridian Events Center. And then finally, we deeply appreciate the voters of Salt Lake County. Their approval of Zoo Arts and Parks has provided invaluable support to this museum for this series, but also for our exhibits, for our programs, for everything you see here. And it's been an incredible gift to the to many cultural organizations across Salt Lake County. So please join me in thanking these wonderful partners and supporters. So now to tonight's speaker. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. David Gallo. David is an American oceanographer and director of special projects at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a preeminent, globally recognized scientific laboratory in New York. For more than 25 years, David has been at the forefront of ocean exploration, witnessing and contributing to the development of new technologies and scientific discoveries that shape our view of the blue planet. David has participated in expeditions to all of the world's oceans and was one of the first scientists to use a combination of robots and submarines to explore the seafloor, the deep seafloor. Most recently, he co-led an expedition to create the first detailed and comprehensive map of the RMS Titanic. He also co-led the successful U.S. effort to locate the wreck site of Air France Flight 447 in the mid-Atlantic, and he's currently involved in the search for missing Malaysian Air Flight 370 in the Indian Ocean. David is passionate about the relationship between humanity and the sea. He firmly believes that instead of taking the oceans for granted, we must recognize the ocean's critical role in providing the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Gallo.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. What a pleasure to be here. And actually, these days with travel, I'm always glad to get where I'm going in the same week that I left. It's always and it was trying a bit this time. But you know, thanks to the generosity of people here, it's been painless, and more or less. So and this facility, I have to tell you, I've been to hundreds of museums around the planet, and I've never seen anything quite like this. what a wonderful gem here. And not just from what you see inside, which is so beautiful, and you can tell how much love and thought has gone into this, and effort has gone into this, but also the way it blends in with the natural world around it is fantastic. Congratulations. I'm very jealous. I should say, too, that I should have told Sarah that I just retired after 30 years at Woods Hole. And it's not important to me because I never quite thought of it as a job. I'm still doing everything I did when I had a job at Woods Hole. And in fact, I took on another role at Columbia University. The same day I retired from Woods Hole, I began at Columbia University as senior advisor in the Center for Climate and Life. So I want to look more at, so what does this all mean for people? You know, what is this crazy world of ours? How do we affect it? How does it affect us? But so I've actually doubled my workload, which is classic because if I'm Dave Gallo PhD, but I'm also, I had to earn that, but I'm also Dave Gallo ADD, and that I was born with. And early on in life, I had a very difficult time in school. In fact, even though I was always out exploring, I was collecting fossils. I grew up in central New York State on the Finger Lakes, long way from the sea. And I was always outside doing things, either in the lake or at night with my telescope or building model rockets. And but my teacher said, you know, you don't have the aptitude to be a scientist. And my guidance counselors would always remind me that I should probably focus on doing something more manual with my hands than with my brain when I graduated, which was okay. I mean, I trusted them. I believed in them. And I sold shoes for 7 years after high school. And one day, I even tried community college once, and I bombed out quickly in community college. I just had no idea what taking notes was all about. I just didn't understand. And then one day, I was standing in the shoe department, and I was flipping through a National Geographic magazine, and there was an article in there by Robert Ballard. He had just been on a trip to the Caribbean. And it showed this little tiny speck on an underwater mountain, and it said this mountain's higher than the Alps, and that little speck is the submarine Elvin, and inside that little speck, it was a blow-up. It was Bob Ballard and two other people. And there's something about that that reminded me of my youth, of my excitement, and my passion for exploration as a child, and it threw a switch. I didn't get suddenly smarter, but it threw that switch again, because as a child, even though I had a hard time reading, there's one book I read about 10 times. It was called Kon-Tiki by Thor Heyerdahl, and it was a story of about how this Norwegian explorer built, with his team, built a raft out of balsa, and he sailed it across the Pacific. And there was something about that whole bit about being out at sea, the unknown animal, the animals that would show up at night, the challenges of being out there on this raft with his team, and that just intrigued me. And I read it again and again and again. And so, I did try to replicate that as a child. I didn't have balsa with my friends. I didn't have Norwegian shipbuilders either. I had my friends Jimmy Kukela and Alan Kowalski, and we built a raft out of railroad ties that weighed about 30,000 pounds that never made it anywhere near the water, thank goodness. But it convinced me that my teachers were probably right. I took in that article, in that National Geographic article, it was 1976, I was in my mid-20s, was a guy from State University of New York at Albany, right across the parking lot from the shopping mall where I was selling shoes. So I took it over there, that article, and met the guy, Paul Fox, and I had questions for him, and every question I asked was greeted with the answer that, you know, we don't know, and that's a great question, and here's what we need to do, and you ought to follow that up, read this, read that, and I did. I dug in, and anyone with ADD knows that you can hyper-focus, and I did, and 2 years later, I made my first dive in that submarine in Elvin, because I was determined, got my bachelor's degree, and then my master's degree. It wasn't easy, but I had to work really hard. I saw the sun rise and set many times, and then eventually got a call from Bob Ballard at Woods Hole, 1986 it was. He said, I just found the Titanic. I said, yeah, I heard. And he said, I'd like you to come to Woods Hole to be my assistant director of Center for Marine Exploration. And he said, I don't know if I can pay you a penny, and I don't know what you'll be doing, but I guarantee you it'll be the first time anyone's ever done it. And I said, that's it, I'm there. So I went to Woods Hole, and I remember my first expedition with Bob. We were in the Mediterranean. It was more than I could ask for. We left from Gibraltar on a ship with Bob and his team and National Geographic, and the film crew was here, and Bob was there, and there I was right between them. And the sun was coming up over the eastern Mediterranean, this big orange fireball, and the mist was rising, and you could see fishing boats in the distance. And I thought about all the history that was going on and that had gone on in that spot, you know, the crucible of civilization. And the director said to me, I've got a question for you. And I said, well, this is great. I'm going to actually be in National Geographic. He said, well, was it really hard to go from selling shoes to working with the best and brightest at the bottom of the sea? And I said, you know, actually not, because after the first 1,000 feet or so, both jobs get a lot tougher. It's the truth. I don't even know if that's funny, but that's what I said. It's been the past 30 years for me have been marvelous. I don't know. I was thinking last night how incredibly privileged I've been to have seen the things I've seen, worked with the people I've worked with, people whose names you never hear, but they're the true heroes to me of exploration. And they're out there right now as we speak, you know, fighting against Mother Nature, sometimes working with Mother Nature, but appreciating every moment of it. And I want to share some of that with you. And that's the thing I find most rewarding, is being able to share some of this, not in the hopes of saying, boy, that Dave Gallo, he did a lot, but hopefully I can, just like that article did to me, through a switch, and I said, well, that's great stuff. Maybe I can wake up that little bit of Jacques Cousteau that's in all of us. And so you might see something here that you go, wow, I want to know more about that. That's fascinating. You know, really, I should be able to just stop with that. Make sure this is on. With that one image of the Earth from space, because that's an incredible thing that we could do that, and yet we take it so much for granted. Yes, the Earth from space. Well, when you think of all the technology that went into that, all the hard work, all the risks that we took, there's nothing in our DNA that says that we should be able to get off of our own planet as a species and look back on Earth and where all of our ancestors lived, and probably the next 100 generations, will, most of us will live on that planet. It's an amazing thing, and like I said, yet we take it for granted that it's the Earth. The other thing it fools us into believing is that we know all about it, and we don't. In fact, we know very little about this planet. And that's the same planet. I just rotated the planet around. We take the clouds away. It's a Google Earth view of the Earth. That's the Pacific Ocean you're looking at there. The Hawaiian Islands are right here. And actually, these are the islands we know, from the Big Island to Kauai and like. And then they actually are sinking slowly into the Pacific Ocean. And so you can actually follow the trace of the islands across the Pacific Ocean. They take a right turn here and go up to the Aleutians. So that's the Hawaiian Islands. There's a little bit in New Zealand here and then North America right there. But for the most part, it's all water. 70% of the Earth covered with water. You know, we say that, it's cliche. And the average depth is about 2 miles, so it's a lot of water. And it's too much to scuba dive in. We have to have very special technology to get to the bottom of that. And so as a result, we've only explored about 5%, and maybe less. You know, that's just a number we pick because it sounds convenient. But so 95% of that ocean, we just don't know much about. And Sarah, as we heard earlier, you know, it's responsible for the air we breathe. Every other breath of fresh air you take, we can thank the ocean for that oxygen. The food we eat, there's 2 billion people on the planet of the 7 billion that rely directly on the oceans for food. And the water we drink right here in Salt Lake, that the water, your rainfall patterns begin out in the Pacific Ocean for the most part, a little bit Gulf of Mexico, but start way out in the Pacific Ocean with things like El Nino. So the food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, you would think that we would understand the oceans a little bit better than not having even explored them. So it's very odd that way, that we're happy to live that like that. It's not a big blue fishbowl. And this is a map of the seafloor. And the things I want to show you here, right here in the middle of the ocean, is a mountain range. 50,000 miles long. It's called the Mid-Ocean Ridge, and it dwarfs, here's the Rocky Mountains here. So it's much longer than the Rocky Mountains. There's the Alps, the Pyrenees right here, the Himalayas right here. There's thousands of peaks along that are many times higher than any of the peaks in the Rockies or in the Alps, thousands of them. There's thousands of valleys that crisscross this mountain range. It's cut by all these valleys that are five times wider, five times deeper than the Grand Canyon. Some of them 100 times longer, 1,000 times longer than the Grand Canyon. So you have underwater mountains, you have underwater peaks, you have underwater mountain ranges, you have underwater valleys. You have rivers that run through the ocean. We call them currents when they're at the surface, like the Gulf Stream here is a current, but it's really a river of heat. But we also have currents that hug the bottom of the ocean. They're cold water currents, and they hug the bottom. And in places, they cut their way across the bottom of the ocean, just like a river does on land. And they where they go over scarps or cliffs, they make waterfalls. We have underwater waterfalls, and we even have underwater lakes. So I'll show you some of that in a little bit. So it's not the big blue fishbowl we thought it was. And even in that 5%, we're finding all of that we have explored, we're finding all of these incredibly dramatic things. And as I said before, we already know the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, just in the little bits we've seen. So you've got to wonder, well, what's the rest of it? What have we missed out there, the 95%? Is it empty of stuff, or is it full of more surprises? And we're sure it's full of more surprises. This is a mosaic of the earth, of the land, that taken over time. And I like to show it because where it's green, it shows that there's rainfall and things growing, and where it's brown, it's desert. And so here's the Great Sahara Desert, then up through the Middle East and up into China, the Gobi Desert and the like. And I love it because on here, and even with the best binoculars, it would be, from this distance, hard to see, are the 7 billion people that live on this planet. We're almost like microbes or a virus that lives on this planet. And just like a virus, we've managed to change over time. We've changed the chemistry of seawater. If you go to the middle of the Pacific and catch a fish, or the middle of the Atlantic and catch a fish, more often than not, if you look at the stomach contents, you'll find little bright bits of plastic in the fish's stomach, even in the middle of nowhere. If you look at the flesh and look at the chemistry in the flesh of the fish, you find herbicides, pesticides, pharmaceuticals, Prozac is a great one, caffeine, all the kinds of things that we think are good for us, flame retardants, that's another big one, building up to toxic levels in some animals. So the stuff that's good for us and good for life, we think, is slowly trickling off of our shorelines, off of our farmers' fields, off of our golf courses, backyards, city streets. And eventually, no matter where you live, whether it's Salt Lake or Cape Cod or Tokyo, eventually it makes its way into the sea. And it turns out over time that it's deadly stuff for the ocean. So this virus that we are, in effect, on this planet, we've managed to change the chemistry of seawater. We've also put enough carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that the oceans are absorbing about a third of it. And that's human-created stuff. There's no debate about whether it's human or not. But the oceans absorb the carbon dioxide, and it turns into acid, carbonic acid. So any animal that wants to make a shell or a skeleton out of seawater has a hard time doing it. So that's all on us. And, we didn't know about it, and it's hard to get the press to the media to pay attention because it's not an event. It's not an oil spill. There's no dead birds covered with oil. There's no boat broken in two on the rocks with smoke billowing out of it. So it's not very attractive to the media, but it's one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now is the pollution, simple as that, of the world's oceans. Also, we're fighting this idea about what are the oceans, and most people, more than half the people on Earth, live within about 100 miles or so of a shoreline, and a lot of us think of this as the ocean. It's a picture of a beach, and it's a lovely place to be, and it's a very important part of the ocean, but it's not the whole ocean. And so we're fighting that misconception that that's all we need to worry about. There's a whole lot more out there. And this is a New Yorker cartoon, and I love it because it's some ladies having tea or coffee, maybe. And I don't know why I don't care about the bottom of the ocean, but I don't. And when you get in the New Yorker with a joke like that, a cartoon like that, that you're missing the point, that people are not paying attention to something they ought to be paying attention to. And in fact, a lot of the things that were headline news, the missing aircraft, the Fukushima tsunami, the Indonesian tsunami, they do have to do with the ocean bottom. The Gulf oil spill that we had to live with for so long in the Gulf of Mexico, that's the seafloor too. So we need to know about this thing that most people don't care about or even think about. And this is the slogan of McCann Erickson in New York City, an advertising firm. Truth well told. And I love it because as scientists, we try to get at the truth. You know, we sometimes get close. We never always get there perfectly because that's the business of science. There's always debate. But the truth is our business. But the well told part, we're horrible at that. And often we turn all over our results to the media, and the media always tends to exaggerate things so that it's more palatable or more attractive to the public. Ratings, you know, we got to have the ratings. And one example is that there's an island the size of Texas of plastic bottles floating around the Pacific. Well, there isn't. You know, in fact, it's much worse than that, but they've built up this thing in the public's mind so that you can visualize it. Wow, that's horrible. But, you know, when the public finds out that it's not true, that's not so good. So we're more about these days about let's just give the public the truth about what we know, what we don't know, what we need to know. So much is depending on technology, and you can't just go to Avis or Hertz and rent a robot to go to the bottom of the sea. So we have to build all that kind of technology to work at the seafloor. And I love astronauts, and I'm not taking anything away from space, but the budgets are completely lopsided for going into space. We're talking about between 10 and $20 billion a year, and for the oceans, maybe a fraction of that. Maybe it's $1 billion or $2 billion a year. And that's about the planet we're living on. I don't say take money away from that and give it to the oceans, but we really should put a little bit more effort into understanding our own living space. And China, sadly enough, or good for China, has taken the lead in building some of the newest technology. They've got the best, most modern sub on the planet. Our submarine's an old jalopy. We just upgraded it, but it's still the most productive. But you know, China's making a concerted effort to take the lead. One thing you can't buy or build is mentorship. And I made the mistake. I show three men here, and I should show some women on board the ship because they play an equally as important role as the men. We have women captains of ship, female captains of ships, and robot drivers, and certainly scientists and pilots for the submarine. But here, anyway, I show three men. And the reason I show it is because we've got these two old salts on either side. They're in their 60s, and in the middle is a young guy, Kevin Manganini. He's in his 20s. And they're learning how to do things that you can't learn out of a book in a classroom. It's learned, been passed down over years from people that have gone out to sea. So the technology is important, the team's important, and then you need the teamwork and philosophy. And for that, I turned to Yogi Berra, who said, you can observe a lot just by watching. And it took us a while to realize that. Rest in peace, Yogi. But we used to go, when we used to dive into the deep willy-nilly, all over the place looking for something exciting. And now we've learned that sometimes the best thing to do is to sit still and let nature come to us. And it's hard to do that. It really is hard to do that, but we're learning. I want to go back to that mountain range now and look at it. Here's the Atlantic Ocean. So Cape Cod's right here. And this is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or Mid-Ocean Ridge right here, that mountain range. And you can see the shape of it. This mimics the shape of Northwest Africa, and also the shape of the eastern coast right here. So this used to be there, and that used to be there, and this used to be there, and that used to be there, and it all used to be together in this one thing called Pangaea. And you know, it always amazes me that we have a hard time accepting climate change, but we didn't have such a hard time accepting plate tectonics, which says that the continents are floating around, moving around the face of the earth constantly. And this is one example of it, one of tectonic model. So here's millions of years ago, 190 million years ago. There's the Atlantic Ocean opening up about 180 million years ago. At about 120, the South Atlantic Ocean's up. Ocean opens up. And then there used to be an ocean right here called Tethys. And as India slams into Asia, Tethys begins to disappear and the Atlantic starts to grow. And it's still going. It didn't stop, so which is important for us to understand that. The thing that reminds us are earthquakes and volcanoes. Remind us that the plates are constantly moving and the face of the earth is constantly changing. And one of the messages we get from the oceans loud and clear is that both the continents, the face of the earth, and the climate on the planet have been changing for 5 billion years. It'll never be the same tomorrow as it is today. It's changing, part of a natural cycle. It doesn't mean we haven't impacted it. We have. We've caused our own little addition to that cycle, to those rhythms and cycles, and it makes it hard to predict what's coming next because we don't have such a long record of life on this planet, but we're getting there. The answers are out there. And so much depends on exploration, you know, about going out on a ship like this. This is our ship Atlantis. It holds 50 people. That's the pilot in the submarine Elvin looking out the porthole. The porthole's about that thick, the material, the plexiglass on the in the porthole. So there's three people inside that submarine, and everyone asking the same very important question, should I go to the bathroom one more time before we leave the ship? It's a 10-hour day in the sub, sometimes 12 hours. So three of you inside there, over the side you go, and no matter how many times you dive, this part of the dive is amazing. This lovely color blue, it just saturates your very spirit. You don't hear the surface ship anymore. Those sounds go away, the machinery, but you hear the pinging of the sonar down to the bottom and back. If there's animals in the water, like whales or dolphins, you can hear them. Divers check out the sub and give you the okay, the all clear, and then down you go. And it's a 2.5-hour trip to the bottom. So the first half hour you spend going from light blue to deep blue to dark blue into pitch black. So you go through this twilight zone where we thought life would exist because there's still some sunlight. But we thought for the most part that 2-hour trip in the darkness where there's never been sun, there should be no life at all. And what amazed us is when we stopped and looked, we find that it's full of life. That's another message from the sea. One of the deep secrets, deep sea deep secrets, is that life really wants to happen. And this one is about 8 inches long. It's a jellyfish. These are individual fishing lures, I call them down here, stinging tentacles, stomachs, jet thrusters up here, and a little light in its head. And fully grown would be almost as wide as this auditorium is up here. So it can be, actually it can be about 100 feet long. So an incredibly long and fragile animal. Every shape and size, incredibly fragile and delicate. And what we did in the past was pull the net through these waters, and then at the end of a few hours, you'd pull the net up to the surface ship, and then you'd end up with a net full of body parts and mush, and with a microscope, try to put these animals back together again, having never seen them. And it was impossible. It's just something that's almost impossible to do. But now that we know they exist, we can get in the water. We've got very good cameras, so we're getting in the water with them. And we can get as close as we want to get and as highly magnified as we want to. And so we're studying these animals now better than ever. And again, almost every expedition into the deep is finding something new about life in that blanket of water that we thought was just empty. This is a little octopus that's about that big, you know, just a few inches across, and it's got the very scientific name, Squishy. Squishy's a great little animal. You can see through his head. I love that. It's like half jelly, half octopus. If you go all the way to the sea floor, you have the record of Earth history, sediments that rain down. And sometimes you have the record of human history. And sometimes that record comes in big clumps, and Titanic is one of those big clumps from 1912. And this image was the cover of Bob Ballard's book, Discovery of the Titanic. And it's something I've lived with every day since I first saw it. It sits over my desk. Mostly because of jealousy, because this is not a photograph. It's a painting done by an artist and named Ken Marshall. And it's so detailed and so accurate that it's something that we could never do with our technology. We had robots like this little one that's looking at the anchor here, and we had the submarine that's sitting on the deck, but we didn't have the ability to put it all together into one image. So we needed a lot more. You know, at the bottom of the ocean, there's no GPS. We have to, the radio waves don't work underwater. We have to use sound. We have to bring our own power. The pressure is incredible. It's intense. In space, you can see eternity. At the bottom of the ocean, you can't see your hand in front of your face. So we're hampered by all of those things that we had to find ways to get around it. And we had to find ways to get around it. And with video, we had some success early on. This is Titanic again. We're coming up on the bow here with a robot. There's the anchor, starboard side, port side. Here's the bow where Jack was king of the world right here. There's a little creature growing right there on Titanic. There's an anchor. And the thing about Titanic, we went in 2010. We're going to go back again, I hope, this summer, later this year. There we are sitting on the deck of the Titanic. These are the anchor chains. We learn a lot from Titanic. One is that we learn is that when ships sink, even today, we commit the ship and the souls for eternity to the deep. When you think about that, we never expect to see it again. We just said, oh, it's in the deep ocean. We're never going to see it again. It's in the blackness of the deep, the darkness of the deep. This is where the steering wheel on Titanic would be. These are the officers' quarters right here. And now here we are with our robots, with our submarines and cameras. We've crossed into this thing that we once called eternity. So when we go there with an incredible amount of reverence. We've never touched anything on Titanic unless we absolutely have to, because of a forensic scientist wants to study something about the ship and how it came apart or learn something new about the people on board. Every single year, about 14 ships the size of Titanic sink to the bottom of the ocean. They're not passenger liners. They're carrying cargo or oil, and they sink in the middle of nowhere, typically, with the crews of maybe 20 people. But again, just like Titanic, we would just write it off and say it's gone to the deep for eternity. But that's not satisfying anymore to the families, to the shipbuilders, to the insurance companies. So more and more now are being asked to go out and look for these, ships. We've already seen that. I want to get past that. So it's not just the hull of Titanic that we're looking at. We've also learned a lot from the seafloor around Titanic. The hull is a very good place. It's very touristy. People that go to Titanic want to see the bow, the stern, the bridge, the propellers, the grand staircase. But all around Titanic, there's 100,000 and maybe more artifacts sitting on the bottom. That's a piece of a bench. There's cables, there's lights, there's wires, there's shoes, there's personal artifacts, like there's perfume bottles. There are coins, there's jewelry. And again, we haven't touched any of that. We just are taking an inventory of what's out there. And as dispassionate as science is supposed to be, I could always tell when there was something very emotional on the screen, because all this is being piped live to the surface ship from a robot. This is one of those moments where we see a cup on the bottom, and it's got the White Star logo sitting here, and it says White Star Line. And those are always special moments, and I enjoyed them because it reminded me that science, even though we say it's supposed to be very cold, you can't help yourself by some of the things we study but enjoy about what you're looking at, and it has a deeper meaning than that. These are some of the maps we made. This is the bow of Titanic, and that's the stern. And we've gotten very good at studying both of those because one of them is in great shape. The bow is in great shape. This is looking down on them. The stern, on the other hand, the ocean just mangled it and ripped it to shreds like a piece of confetti. The bow filled up with water because it hit the iceberg and filled with water, broke off the ship, and then sank to the bottom. There was nothing for the ocean to crush. But the stern bobbed around, if you remember the movie, for a while. Had a lot of air pockets in it, and as soon as it went underwater, the ocean mangled it. It didn't even get very deep. It was just crushed to bits. And yet we're trying to solve things like there's a hatch missing here, and we finally found the hatch. There's the hatch. So little by little, it may seem like polishing the head of a pin, but you know it's important for us to understand these ships. And this is a side view of Titanic, the port side, the starboard side, and here we're looking for where exactly is the iceberg damage. And for a while, we thought it might be here. There's a giant hole in the Titanic right there. But we see that on both sides. So now we know that it wasn't that. It would only be on one side if it was the iceberg damage. So we found a place right down here where there's just about a 40-foot long stretch of the hull. It's just been creased and unfolded, like when you fold a piece of paper, enough that it popped all the rivets. And that would have been impossible on the inside of the ship to fix that. And so we think that right there, just that little bit, it's not a lot of little gashes, 1,000 cuts, and it's not one giant gash, it's a lot of little, it's one area of just simple folding the hull a bit, just a little nudge against the iceberg that brought Titanic to the bottom. And I thought, finally, we've got Ken Marshall, because there's no way that he could have seen that little thing that we finally saw. And sure enough, here's a picture, another drawing of Ken's, with our submarine sitting here looking at the masts with the crow's nest. And right here is that piece that I just showed you, with that little piece of foliage. So we even had that. So Titanic is interesting. It's not something that ever interested me, because I was interested in pure exploration. Not, you know, Titanic, we knew what it was. It was just a matter of finding it. It's the things that surprise you in the ocean that I get more attracted to, like this. This is the top of that mountain range, and that's a hot spring under the ocean. It looks like black smoke. It's really super toxic water. You couldn't get a permit to dump that in the ocean if you tried, but it's coming out all along the top of that mountain range. It's full of that rotten egg smell, hydrogen sulfide. The temperature alone at the base of these chimneys is about 700 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's incredibly hot, incredibly toxic. Never been any sunlight here, 2-3 miles deep. The pressure is incredible. It would crush the Titanic like you could crush an empty paper cup in your hand. And there's never been any, there's constant earthquakes and volcanoes. So we were positive that there'd be no life here at all along the top of that mountain range. And one day, geologists poking around in the submarine looking for volcanic rocks came across one of these things. And these are pillars of life. They're volcanic rocks, probably as high as this auditorium, but full of life. And everything on here is living, is a living animal, all of them very strange animals indeed. None of them relying on the sun, but all of them living off microbes that eat that poison chemical stuff and turn it into food for these larger animals. These are called tube worms, these white tubes with the red tips. That's hemoglobin that is the same as our blood. There's crabs. You see that the tips actually retract in, and here the crabs have managed to get a piece of tube worm right there. So having a snack, and this is a fish. It looks like an eel, but it's a fish. In one spot, 300 species of life, and 297 never been seen before, brand new species. And the animals here, again, are living off chemosynthesis, the chemical energy from the earth out, not from the sun down. So in one instance of exploration, we managed to revolutionize the way we think about life, not just on Earth, but on other planets as well. You don't have to have the sunlight to have not only little bits of life, but abundant life. These are really thriving communities. Actually, in terms of density of animals and diversity of animals, rivals the tropical rainforest, which is pretty amazing. Okay. I want to show you one more scene. So here's a puddle of water, this nighttime view. This water sitting right here, we'll zoom in a moment. And you see the ripples here, and there's a rock ledge, and the waves have actually worn away at the ledge, and there's a little beach back here. Well, what you're looking at here, that water, those ripples, are at the bottom of the ocean. So you'd be sitting in your submarine, looking out the window of the sub, and saying, wait a minute, I'm looking at waves in a shoreline, and there are animals that live along the shoreline that don't go in there. There's animals that live in there. In fact, the biologist once right away said, well, that water's so dense, it's super dense, it's super toxic, it's hydrogen sulfide and methane and other things. He said, well, nothing could live in there. And we said, that's absolutely right, except for all the animals that are living in there that don't know that rule because it's full of things like, from what we can see, like brine shrimp. And actually, the sub tried to go in there. It was so dense that the submarine couldn't sink down into these lakes. This is a fairly small one, so that's a fairly small pool, but we've seen some now that are about 10 miles long, a mile across, and several hundred feet deep, we think, in the Mediterranean. So now that we know they're there, we'll be exploring them a little bit more, trying to understand what exactly they are, because they're so unbelievably odd to look at that when you get to the bottom of the ocean, you see a body of water inside the... It's like oil and vinegar in a jar that they don't mix. And that's what a river looks like moving across the seafloor. So you can see the ripples as it goes across the ocean floor. And I don't want you to think that it's all just the deep ocean. This is the work by a guy named Roger Hanlon. and he studies shallow water, and he's learned from Yogi sometimes better to sit and watch, and he's watching this octopus try to hide from Roger. Octopuses are very good at camouflage, and not just in changing their color, which this one's doing, but finding a spot and changing texture too. And we didn't know that so much, but you can see he finds a spot, curls up his tentacles, and then settles in with the corals and disappears into the background. And even squid have uncanny abilities. These are two males, and they're fighting. The one on the bottom, when it turns that light color, is very aggressive. Here's a female on the right and a male on the left, and he's smart enough that he splits his body color so she only always sees Mr. Nice Guy. And all the other male squid out here on the outside see Mr. Stay Away, Mr. Aggressive. And what's amazing is when they switch positions, you'll see that she's moving over to the left, and he says, oh no, I'm going to be found out. So he slides to the back, switches his colors around, and comes back up Mr. Nice Guy. I'm told that's being called two-faced, and it's not just squid that amongst males that do that. I don't know what that means. Cuttlefish, this one's looking at Roger, and Roger's looking at him. It's camouflaged so it can hide in these rocks back here, so it's done that. But it's got to do something with these tentacles, and you'll see what he does with his tentacles. Yep, just fits right into the background. And they have to do that, I mean, to survive. There's some very good efficient predators in the deep ocean, like the barracuda. And so if you're an octopus and you want to survive, you better know how to hide in those areas. And I'll show you in this next clip, I think, Roger, this is his best. There's a very large octopus hiding here. And I'll tell you now, there's some algae sitting here. It's light color, large octopus, smooth skin. And you'll see him right now. There he is. And that's his eye. And then he sees Roger, and off he goes. And then Roger's in hot pursuit. And then when Roger catches up to him, he tries to bluff by making his eye spot very big and his body very big. But Roger's not fooled by that. And anyway, we're going to run that backwards and have a look at this. And so here on the right, you have that animal that's light-colored and smooth-skinned. And it's hard to believe that this animal can turn into this algae over here. And this is very slow motion, but it happens very quickly, and there he goes. It's just gone. This is some of Roger's older work. Some of his newer stuff is even more fascinating. So even in shallow water, we're learning an awful lot about the world beneath the sea. And it's just one marvel after another. And you know, at some point, you want to put the science aside and just be marveled by what's out there, by creation. It's just an amazing, amazing planet when you start to look at all these things together. Let me go back to the human story again, in that this is Air France Flight 447, and it's not something that we were trained to do at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, but in June 1st, 2009, this plane with 238 people on board disappeared over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and in fact, right over the top of that underwater mountain range. And we knew that the plane was missing because it certainly didn't show up after being lost for a few hours. And then within a day or so, people started finding parts of the plane on the surface of the ocean. There's the tail fin, a bit of the galley. And, you know, it's a plane because it was in deep water. It was really one of the first ones that the seafloor, this is what a map of the seafloor looks like, was so rugged that people were saying, well, we'll never find it. So that once again, we commit the ship, the plane, and the souls aboard for eternity to the deep. And we thought about it at Woods Hole for some time. We weren't involved in the early search. And eventually, we got the confidence of the French government and the Brazilian government. And then, more importantly, the confidence of the families of the victims, the people lost on the plane, and of Air France and of Airbus, the people that flew the plane, the people that made the plane. So we went out. And the first year was it was a wild goose chase, 2 months. We were told the plane was 98% certain was in that box, and it was not in the box at all. And that was horrible because the pressures were horrible on us. We felt like we let everyone down. But then we eventually made the argument that we could do this, that if the plane was there, we would have seen it. So we got an opportunity to go back out. And we went out with one ship with several brand new robots, these yellow torpedoes, our robots, and within about a week's time, saw this smudge sitting on the seafloor, and told the robots, that looks odd, take some photos, and sure enough, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there was the remains of Air France Flight 447. And it was an immense relief, but nothing to open champagne bottles about. You know, we had found the gravesite of these poor innocent people. But we made a map of the entire site, first time that's ever been done. We learned how to do that from Titanic. And then came the discovery of the black boxes, and fortunately, even though they were in the bottom for 2 years in very deep water, same depth as Titanic, 2.5 miles, this information was still there. So people were able to put together what happened that night in 2 years ago. And the best part was that I remember when I was actually not on board the ship when the plane was found, and I got the phone call, and I looked up at the sky, and there were planes going over Cape Cod to Europe. And I remember thinking how that we had now changed, made the world a little bit safer, because never again would a plane be lost out in the middle of the ocean, because we had promised that we would track them forever. And then there came this, the Malaysian Flight 370. And it's been 2 years, so it's been a long time. And for 2 years, there have been people out there looking. We have not been out there on the water. We've been watching and helping as much as we've been asked from the shore. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I think I hear rumors that the Australians are going to call off the search. I know that will be crushing to the families and loved ones of the victims. So we'll see what happens. But and the question remains about whether the plane is anywhere near these areas where they're looking. So back to this, and to wrap up on this, our beloved planet, and back to the 7 billion people slide. You know, I think we owe it. Well, we don't have to do anything, frankly. We can keep living the way we're living. And if someone watched us from the moon, they'd think we were the most bizarre species that ever lived, probably, because we seem to be doing everything we can do to make this an uninhabitable place. You know, we're using our resources wildly. We're not respecting the atmosphere and the oceans the way we should. I'm not saying it's a crisis, and I'm not saying that shame on us, because honestly, we didn't know. Maybe we should have had some idea, but we always thought the atmosphere, well, that's huge. It's not. It's not huge. There's not a lot of atmosphere up there. And the oceans, we always thought, were quote-unquote too big to fail. So who knew that the coffee that you pour in your backyard eventually is going to make its way, the caffeine, out into the ocean? And then when you multiply that one half a cup of caffeine by a million or two, it really is a good jolt. To the animals out at sea. We didn't know, and now we do. So now comes the difficult task of, you know, what do we do about it? And it's if we want to make a difference, we're going to have to change habits. Nothing too radical, but changing habits is not easy, because they're not the most obvious habits. And I'm not not the world's greatest environmentalist. You know, I love Amazon.com. I order books from China that will show up in my office tomorrow, and I won't read them for 5 years, but they just flew around the world. And that's not good. You know, that's not good. And I haven't changed all the light bulbs in my home, and I don't drive a Prius and all that stuff, so how serious could I be? But, you know, there has to be a balance between life on the planet. And I think a lot of it has to do with respect, that we have to come right back to that we need to respect the Earth. And I just want to leave you with just a couple of images. That one's washed out, but I'll zoom in. It'll be more obvious. That's the Earth at night, North America. The white lights, that's us. That's electricity. That's the quote-unquote developed world, and you can certainly see us, and you can see Salt Lake, and you can notice I don't know exactly where Salt Lake is, so I just kind of... Europe, there's Spain here, and England. And now you see some red lights. Those are gas flares. That's the brightest thing on Earth from space. And that's Siberia. That's the Persian Gulf down inside here. So those are gas flares. And this is Korea. There's Seoul, Korea. Lots of white lights inside here, very developed. And then North Korea, not a lot going on. There's Pyongyang right there. Or is that Pyongyang? I'm not sure. One of those is. There's Japan, the islands of Japan. And the thing here are these blue lights. Those are fishing fleets. and they're almost clouds of blue. There's so many boats out there. And on top of changing the chemistry and temperature of the ocean water, we've got our ships out there catching fish at record numbers, and sometimes not supervised very well. You know, we don't know much about fish stocks on the planet, but we do know that the big fisheries are collapsing. And so we need to do something about that. But the problem is that we've got to do it based on fact as much as emotion. We can't do everything just based on emotion. And we've learned the hard way with unintended consequences, like, for instance, in the Gulf oil spill, we added dispersants to the oil, chemicals, detergents and things to the oil so that we wouldn't see it so much. That would break up the big clumps. And, you know, most of the oil was eaten by microbes over time, but those detergents, which are really caustic and dangerous to the environment, still persist. They're still out there sloshing around. That's on us, and all driven by the emotions more than fact about what we were doing. So then we come to the last thing. This is Africa, and it's a little bit washed out, but there's the Sahara, nothing going on there. The Nile River Valley is one of the most populated places on Earth, and all white lights here. This is Nigeria right here, the gas flares in Nigeria. But all these gold dots, those are village fires, and villages burning solid fuel for light, for food, for cooking, for heat. And what amazed me and us is that from here on up through the Middle East, on up into Asia, there's about 2 billion people that every single day are in a struggle to stay alive because they don't have one thing that we take again for granted, this stuff, fresh water, sanitary water. And women in some of these villages walking 5 or more hours a day for a jug of water that they know is going to make their family sick and eventually kill their children. So that's crazy. And we started to say, well, what's going on with water on the planet, that this is the water planet, and how can that be? And it's all wrapped up in this horrible figure that I used to hate as a student, and I still hate it, but boy, is it important. And we need to understand it, not just the big picture of evaporation from the ocean, it's the rainfall picture, evaporation and rain, and it's all these little things that we need to understand, all the feedback mechanisms that are detailed and difficult, but they're so important. So we'd said, well, how much water is on the Earth anyway? And where does it go? Well, where does it go is tough to predict because it's driven by the winds and by heat, and it looks like that when you speed it up. So it's it makes you feel bad for meteorologists. But what's driving that is this, is the ocean beneath it, is heat from the ocean, and that's not simple either. That's the Gulf Stream you see here. There's Florida, and you'll see in a moment we'll turn the heat on. And that's a river of heat that keeps Europe nice and toasty. But look at that. I mean, that's not easy to predict what's going to be coming up there because it's full of all these eddies and some spinning clockwise, some counterclockwise, and it's always changing day by day, minute by minute. So it's tough to predict. But when you look at the water in general, about how much there is, we took all the water off the Earth. This is the Earth with no water. If the Earth was the size of a basketball and you took all the water off it, it would fit into a ping pong ball. So that if you wanted to make the earth with oceans again, you take that ping pong ball full of water and put it back on the basketball, and it would be thinner than the skin of an onion. And you said, well, Dave, you said 70%. I did. And I said the average depth was 2 miles. Well, that's the surface of the Earth, because it's 2 miles average deep, but that's about 3,000 miles across. So the layer of water is 3,000 miles by two. Again, as thin as the skin of an onion. And the Pacific, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 across by two. So there's hardly any water on Earth at all. It's very little water altogether. That's all the water on Earth. The fresh water, you can barely see it, is that little tiny speck. It's smaller than the laser dot. That's all the fresh water on the planet. It's about 3% of that small blob of the ping pong ball. And for us to live the way we live and other animals like us, you've got to take that little bit of water. It's got to go in just the right places at just the right time of year in just the right amounts, or society takes a toll on society. And sometimes society collapses. And that's probably our biggest challenge today of all those challenges. You know, we're trying to understand the food issues. We're trying to understand the rainfall oxygen issues, about what's going on with our ability to make oxygen from the sea. But probably the most important thing, because we need it immediately, is where is it going to rain, where is it not going to rain, and it's anybody's guess, because the weather systems right now are changing faster than we can understand them. So next time you see this pretty picture, it's okay to take it for granted. It's okay just to marvel at it, yeah, because it's an amazing thing. It's a beautiful, beautiful planet. And it's one through more study that we'll get to appreciate, I hope, more. Because, again, beyond the science, we need to learn to respect and appreciate what we've been given here, what God's given us in the form of this planet. And I'll leave you with a quote by Marcel Proust. He said, "The true voyage of exploration is not so much in seeking new landscapes," and that's something we do, "but in having new eyes." And to us, that means that we finally, with our technology, we can see infinity, we can see the infinitesimal, we can speed things up and watch continents collide, or we can slow things down and walk around a raindrop or a lightning bolt in 3D. That's all great. Technology's given us those new eyes, but it's what we do with it, that information, that turns out to be the most important. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Gallo. You may be listening to this rebroadcast on KCPW 88.3 and 105.5 FM. So we're going to do about 15 minutes of questions. Colleen has a microphone here, so if you would raise your hand. It's hard for us to see with these lights on. Colleen will bring you the microphone.
Is there any way to turn the salt water into fresh water?
That's a very good question. Is there any way to turn the salt water into fresh water? There are ways to do that. There's a couple of ways to do that. It's very expensive. You can boil it. That's one way to do it. You boil the water and collect the fresh water and leave a lot of salt behind. It takes a lot of energy. And the other way to do it is with very fine screens, meshes. And you push the water through and it collects the salt. The problem is that we haven't figured out yet what to do with all the salt that's left behind and how to make it cheap enough. But you know, to me, when lives are in the balance, that is something that we should be paying a lot more attention to. Because I think we're heading for an era where there's haves and have-nots. And it's not just Africa and the Middle East and Asia. It's also California and Nevada, and in some cases Utah, even parts of Utah, that have had less than the kind of precipitation that you expect. So it's an important, that's a very good question. And it's something that people should be working on more than I think that they are working on it.
I'm interested in knowing more about the pH level of the ocean changing, and I'm wondering if people are looking at how quickly it's changing and what the prognosis is for the future.
Yeah, that's what I find is that it's changing. It's not homogeneous, so it's a global phenomenon, the pH change in the ocean. And I regret to say, I don't know exactly where we are now with the pH, but I know that it's patchy. So in certain areas near shore, it's much more radical. There's much, the waters are much more acidic than they are in the middle of the oceans. But it seems to be pretty widespread. But there's a lot of effort going into that right now, into understanding what's going on with pH. And in fact, some people are saying that it's not so bad, a more acidic ocean for some animals. They don't mind it so much. So it's one of these things that we have to keep tabs on so it doesn't get out of control. I think the media's already got ideas that we're looking at an acid earth with dissolving animals, and it's probably not that bad. Yes.
How do you navigate, so to speak, the world of exploration versus what appears to be kind of a mercenary world of let's go find these sunken Spanish ships with all this bullion on them?
Yep.
And how does that all, I mean,
yeah,
it seems like
easy.
It gets tied up in the courts and before you can actually
sure.
do anything.
Well, at Woods Hole, there's a very simple thing, is that we're there to do basic science and to learn. Our treasure, to us, is treasures of the mind, not of the pocket. So we're after science and understanding how the world works, but also how people impact the world and vice versa. So when we get involved with something, one, we're very careful about what we get involved with, so we steer away from anything that's simply treasure hunting. We try not to criticize them, because that hasn't done any good historically to criticize the treasure hunters. There are people that go to Titanic even this day, and Titanic's a protected site, protected by policy, not protected by, you know, no one's keeping an eye on it, and we know people have been out there taking things. So it's sad, it's a sad commentary on humans, but it's a difficult thing, you know, whether you want to be a treasure hunter or not. With Titanic, when it was first discovered by Woods Hole, we said it should be left untouched as a in the memory of those that sailed on board her and of the great ship. But now we need to know how long will it be there, and there are a lot of valuable things there, and the ocean's taking its toll over time. How long will the ship still be there? You know, it's rusting away. Is it 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years? We don't really know. It's just guessing. So we're trying to do those experiments so that someone can make a informed decision about whether to leave the objects behind or collect them. So initially, we were taken aback when the French and Americans went out and collected all the artifacts from Titanic. And then some years later, two of us went to one of the exhibits, the Titanic exhibits, and I was very moved by the whole thing. You know, I thought that it was a great way. Why should just Woods Hole be allowed to, because we had the robots, why should it only be us that could see firsthand that great ship? And this was bringing it to the public. I got that. They weren't selling anything. And now after Air France, I'm starting to think back on it again, because, you know, now I know where there's a spot in the Atlantic Ocean where there are hundreds of iPads and iPhones, and you know, when's it okay to go there and recover all that stuff and make an exhibit out of that? And I don't know that it's ever okay. You know, 10 years from now, I don't think that's okay. 100 years from now, maybe, but it's kind of creepy. So I'm torn on the whole idea. Then again, people have said to me, you know, if it had crashed on land, Air France, or if Titanic happened on land, you wouldn't just leave it sit there, let it sit there. You'd pick up the pieces and do something with them. So it's not an easy, when you really dig into it, it's a tough one. But we try to steer clear of anything that's truly controversial in terms of, we always like a challenge. You know, and Air France was a humanitarian thing, period. And I can't begin to tell you how impressed I was with the teams of people that went out there, and they're out there now, in fact, with Malaysian Air, day after day in harm's way, away from their families. And you'll never hear their names, and they're not getting paid any great. It's not like a big cash bonus. It's your normal pay, but they're doing it because they're trying to provide some relief to the families. So so there's things we get involved with that's not directly a scientific mission. We learn every time we go to sea. We learn something new about the ocean, though. That's a great question. And especially when funding's tough, you know, you start to think about, you know, we know where there's a lot of gold. Maybe we should start. No, that's not going to happen.
How does it feel to go down into the ocean?
It's scary in a way. I mean, everyone on their very first dive, I think, has the same feeling. You get very nervous, of course. You don't worry about dying so much because it's so unusual that you think about what an incredible experience it is. But once you get below where the sunlight is, you start to enter a world that it's an unfamiliar world. And almost all the people that we've taken, and the first time scientists go, they're always amazed by the life that they see on the way to the bottom. And it's difficult to describe, and you can't even take pictures of it, but it's a dream world of, it's like fireflies in your backyard or lightning bugs that you go through this world where there's all these twinkling colors, red, blue, green, and some are darting and some are twinkling and some are blinking, and it's just an amazing experience. And then you get to the bottom and you start to realize that you're sitting on top of you're at the deep in the ocean, but sitting on top of an underwater mountain, and there's hot springs and giant valleys, and then you see these bizarre animals that are beautiful and delicate and So I think it's just when you think back on it, you know, you can. To me, it's always initially as a scientist, you have to do your job, which is to record what you saw on your dive. But personally, I think you have to think that it's just one of the greatest privileges you can have. That for all of humanity's sake, you're the one that gets to see these things and record it. So it's very exciting.
You had my attention completely when you began your story talking about having attention deficit. And
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part.
You captured my attention when you talked about your own experience as a child having attention deficit and the difficulty that presented in school. How can we help young people go from that miserable experience at school to the point where you are, where you cannot retire?
Well, okay, a couple things. I tell teachers a lot, constantly. I mean, that's not the right, I tell them a lot. But I'm pretty open about saying, be careful what you say to kids, because one bad day that you have as a teacher, you might say the wrong sentence and strip the pride away from a child for a lifetime. You know, it took me a lot of time, it took me years to put back that confidence from my teacher. I can still remember my guidance counselors laughing at me, saying, you better figure out something else to do because you're not going to be a scientist, you know. So that's not the right way. It's got to be encouraging. But I think the stigma is the tough part that comes with ADD, that, you know, it's just a different way of looking at things. And a lot of the people I work with have the same issue. They had ADD too. And that's, if you realize that there's a certain power for every bad thing, there's always a silver lining. You've just got to find it. And I had at one point a team of psychiatrists that were trying to figure out, and psychologists, trying to figure out how in the world I got a PhD. I worked and I found coping ways. I would take notes instead of once, I would take notes three or four times. The same thing, I'd rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And I found ways to cope, but I was always driven. As I said before, I didn't get suddenly smarter. I just got driven by my own curiosity and confident, because people said, just go at it, go to it. So I think the encouragement bits a lot too. I'm not a big fan, I hate to say this, I get criticized for it all the time. Standardized tests, you can't measure passion. You know, there's no standardized test for passion. And until there is one, I think these tests are troublesome. I understand why we have the test, but I just think it puts a whole category of students at risk by being outsiders because they're not test takers. I'm certainly not. Even today, people will say, don't invite Gallo to the meeting. We'll spend the entire time looking at his iPad and Amazon.com. So you know, I'm still the same old lady. And in fact, the teachers, I think, and guidance counselors, strictly speaking, were right. That I could not have spent my career looking at one thing my entire career. And that's what you have to do as a scientist. You have to focus in on that one thing, one category, and that wasn't me. So I think that in hindsight, by what they knew, they were right, but it didn't mean I couldn't have a successful field doing what I wanted to do, a successful career. Yes, sir.
You'd mentioned, well, you've implied and directly said there's so much more that could be done with more funding. And I've thought, how could you, and there's all this money for NASA.
Yeah.
And NASA really has captured the imagination of the public.
Yeah.
So in thinking of that avenue for you guys, a couple of years ago on Discovery Channel, there were a couple of the spoof series about a progenitor humanoid that returned to the water and fooled everybody. Kardashian sisters were tweeting about it, and then a megalodon apparently they were hunting in Southern California. And there is the imagination is there on the subject. Do you have any thoughts on how to ignite that same passion?
Your point's very good. I mean, we're wired for curiosity, and there's the oceans certainly have, it's the call of the sea, the rhythms of the sea. It just calls to us as human beings, and we've not been able to capture that. And I think part of the reason is because we gravitate too much to the science and say we need to, and there's an important role for science. But there's also just the thing that got me was that one hand-drawn photo of a mountain range beneath the sea with a little submarine on it. That's all, that one little thing made change got me out of the shoe department. I'm not sure I'm happy that I've been mis-selling shoes, but it's that kind of thing that I think we need to find out. Like I said, I think it's waking up the little bit of Jacques Cousteau in each of us, that little bit of curiosity, to know that it's not all done, that 95% of it's still waiting, and more, still waiting to be explored. But again, I have to come back to, I think at the end of the day, it's about, it's more spiritual thing about what it means to you to have this privilege as a species to be able to see and think about the universe around us. And that's an incredible privilege. And I don't think we recognize that. Again, I think we take it too much for granted that, and we get so caught up into it's all about making a living. And well, it's not really, is it really? I mean, it happens to be about it now for a lot of us, but you know, it's more to me about having the privilege to think about our position in the universe. And okay. I know scientists hate to hear that because they say, that's not our job. Our job is to understand these equations. And that's okay, but it's... Because once you begin to respect and think about our situation, then we've got to learn to not only... It's not just about... you know, it's about acceptance and not just tolerate other people and other people's beliefs. And I don't want to get into the religious arguments about it, but I think when you take the view that, as a scientist, when you start looking at Earth, this tiny little rock in space, you start to realize that we're all in this together and that we really should learn to accept, not just tolerate, but we'll see what happens.
Yes. Okay, we have time for one last question.
Hi. About 30 years ago, I was watching a science show in my country. A narrator said, there's a big wave in the bottom of the ocean, and it travels around the Earth, and it takes 3,000 years to travel. And I'm curious about this ocean. I've been trying to find in Google, but I cannot find about this ocean. Is that a truth? There's a big wave moving the bottom of the ocean?
Yes, there's a field of study, well, physical oceanography. They study waves, not just on this planet, other planets too, like Jupiter. Some people study Jupiter, which is a fascinating place. But there are these waves, that long-term waves that travel around that are very odd. They're not the waves that we think of them as, that you can surf on or that you'd see splashing up on the beach. It's a more physical and a lot of mathematics worked into there. I don't know about that one particularly, but I do know there's the study of those long-term, long wavelength waves is something that some people find fascinating and probably turns out to be very important in the long run. You know, it's like the gravitational waves that people just recorded, that finally we see gravity waves. And, you know, did most of us care about finding gravity waves? No, but it made a lot of people happy, that it made us feel that we understand just one little bit better about the universe around us. Yep. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So I want to thank again Dr. Gallo for an inspiring discussion. We want to thank our sponsors and partners for helping us support this lecture series. We don't know what next year's theme will be, so stay tuned, and thank you again for joining us for the 2016 lecture series.